This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The president went to the White House briefing room today. He was talking budget and deficit and politics.
Our economy right now is headed in the right direction.
But...
and it will stay that way as long as there aren't any more self-inflicted wounds coming out of Washington.
So how are they doing so far? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 5th of February. Glad, as always, to have you with us. We would play you more of what the president had to say today, except that little clip we started with was basically the gist of it. He wants Congress to pass a small-ish set of spending cuts and tax changes to fend off the sequester, those broad-brush cuts, those much bigger broad-brush cuts that are set to hit on March the 1st. Speaker of the House John Boehner said the GOP isn't interested, so it looks like budgets and deficits and debt limits are going to start working their way back into the news sometime soon. There was news today of the biggest leverage buyout we've had in 5 years. Dell is going private in a $24 billion deal led by founder and CEO Michael Dell. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith looks now at what Dell and his partners are going to get for their money.
In the last 5 years, Dell's stock price has tumbled. And there's good reason for that, says tech blogger Brad McCarty.
People in the market only know them as, you know, the dude you're getting a Dell guy.
Dude, you're getting a Dell.
Easy to buy.
That's an ad from Dell's heyday in 2000, when it was the biggest computer maker in the world. Now consumers are trading their PCs in for tablets and smartphones. But the new owners of Dell know there's more to the company than personal computers, says analyst Adrian O'Connell of Gartner Research.
We tend to look at Dell almost as two companies at the moment, or rather we think in terms of old Dell and new Dell.
That new Dell is business services, providing servers and computers to companies and maintaining them. A lot of old guard computer makers have flocked to that sector, including IBM and HP. And that's because it's a growing business, says tech consultant Tim Beharin.
That's the backbone of running any corporation. We've moved into, you know, a data age.
But changing a company's focus takes time, says Beharin, and being public means posting earnings and answering to shareholders every 3 months.
By going private, it takes the quarterly monkey off their back of the shareholders demanding, you know, quarter-by-quarter profit.
Beharin says Dell might sell off its PC business. IBM sold its personal computer business to Lenovo, and its stock price has more than doubled since then. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
You throw the Talking Heads, Standard & Poor's, and Attorney General Eric Holder all together in one big bunch, and what do you get? Well, in this case, you get a lawsuit. Today, the Justice Department announced it's suing S&P over its rosy ratings of some dubious investments in the run-up to the financial crisis. Holder says those ratings were at the very heart of the meltdown. Where, I hear you asking, do the Talking Heads come in? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has that part of the story.
The Justice Department says S&P knew its ratings of investments made up of shaky mortgages were misleading. As proof, it points to a video of an analyst singing a song he wrote about the tanking housing market, set to the Talking Heads song, Burning Down the House. Justice wouldn't share the video with us, so one of our engineers, Bill Lance, grabbed a mic and the doctored lyrics.
Watch out. Housing market went softer, cooling down. Strong market's now much weaker. Subprime is boiling over, bringing down the house.
Could any ripple effects from this lawsuit reach your house? Bill Chambers says possibly. He teaches finance at Boston University. He says if S&P lost and went under, the other two major rating agencies could decide to get out of the business. Chambers says without them, you'd have fewer bond funds to choose from in your 401k plan because fund managers would shy away from unrated bonds.
I think there would be some fewer funds, and the ones that existed wouldn't have the same variety to choose from as well.
David Weiss used to be S&P's chief economist. He now teaches at Brown University. He says the cost of borrowing would go up if rating agencies weren't around to give a borrower a stamp of approval. Banks would have to pay more to borrow the money they lend to consumers. And Weiss says that would trickle down to you and me.
It's going to be harder for folks to get a mortgage, and it could even affect things like credit cards, car loans.
Mike Tay is an investment advisor with Milstein & Company. He says consumers needing jumbo loans to buy a house would have to pay much higher interest rates.
It would ultimately flow down to jumbo borrowers as well as normal mom-and-pop consumers of mortgages as well.
So it might be worth paying attention to the S&P lawsuit, even if you're a Talking Heads fan. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
A correction before we go any further. I was wrong yesterday when I said Warren Buffett owns McGraw-Hill and thus Standard & Poor's. It's Moody's that Berkshire Hathaway owns. Moody's is also a good word as it happens for Wall Street so far this week. Those losses from yesterday, largely all made back. Today we'll have the details when we do the numbers. Tomorrow is a very big day in the lives of some very big young men. Wednesday is National Signing Day, when top high school football players commit to the NCAA institution they have chosen to play for next year. Hardcore college football fans eagerly await their choices, which makes Signing Day the last gasp of that slowly dying office fixture, the fax machine. Marketplace's Mark Garrison explains.
Star high school player O.J. Howard says he's going to play for reigning champion Alabama, but it's not official until he signs a letter of intent. Top recruits like him are teenagers, after all, and they could change their minds. That makes for tense scenes tomorrow morning on campus.
You have coaches, you have administrators, everybody staring at the fax machine, and then you hear that first ring, and everybody freezes.
Jonathan Bowling is University of Alabama's associate athletics director. The ultimate buzzkill is when it turns out to be a spam fax for Caribbean vacations. Like other schools, they're prepping their machine like NASA engineers before launch.
We definitely have it looked at, make sure that the toner is filled up, make sure that we have a new ream of paper in there.
Fans hang on every page, too. Many schools offer live web feeds of their fax machine. Alabama got clicks and controversy a while back when it spiced up its fax web stream by having comely, short-skirted women grab the pages. The NCAA does allow recruits to scan and email their letters, but few do. The fax is still king.
Oh, I love it.
Jonathan Coopersmith is a Texas A&M historian of the fax machine, among other things. For this huge moment in players' lives, the novelty of faxing makes it special.
They have to go back to this old technology. I've got to sign this paper and I have to put it in the machine. Bringing it back makes it a more solemn, more serious, more memorable event.
And with few exceptions, one of the last big moments for the fax machine. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
When you consider typical breakfast beverages, you got your coffee, you got your tea, and right up there in the top three, I'd bet, a nice chilled glass of orange juice. A simple pleasure. Or is it? Turns out there is way more going on in that carton of OJ you've got in your fridge than you might be aware of. Dwayne Stanford covers the beverage industry for Bloomberg News and Bloomberg Businessweek magazine. Most recently, how Coca-Cola gets all that vitamin C goodness to the breakfast table. Dwayne, it's good to have you on the program.
Hello.
So what exactly is Coca-Cola doing to my orange juice, man?
Well, they've for some time now, they've been pushing really hard to build a global orange juice infrastructure. And part of that is moving more towards fresh orange juice instead of that frozen stuff you used to buy in the can and your mom would mix up in a pitcher.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, going fresh juice has a lot better margin, but it also means you're having to do a lot with Mother Nature, which can be very unpredictable.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, because fresh oranges are available, what, like 3-4 months a year, right?
That's right. Yeah, you get about 3, maybe 4 months of peak season. And, of course, people drink orange juice now year-round, so that means they have to store a lot of orange juice, some of it up to 8 months at a time, in giant storage containers that range up to 2 million gallons.
Let me make sure I heard you right. So the glass of orange juice that I'm going to have tomorrow morning is conceivably 8 months old?
It's at least blended, in part, from orange juice that could be up to 8 months old. Might be mixed with some, depending on the time of year, with some orange juice that was in a grove within the last 24 hours.
That's about the least appetizing thing I've ever heard.
Yeah, orange juice is definitely way more complicated than most folks realize. The whole notion of the oranges being plucked off a tree and squeezed into a glass, while that makes for really fantastic marketing, there's a heck of a lot more that goes into it.
Well, you actually go into some of that in your piece in Bloomberg Business Week. You talk about, you know, like a quadrillion variables that they're trying to align to get you that fresh OJ. I mean, this is it's a computer modeling nightmare.
Yeah, one of the innovations that Coke has developed over recent years is to basically figure out how to predict Mother Nature. And a lot of that means collecting data points on everything from the acidity in orange juice to global weather patterns, including global warming patterns. So you marry those two things up in a computer model, and it tells you basically how to blend what you have on hand in order to get that consistent taste all year. And it also tells you how to plan for upcoming anomalies that you wouldn't have expected.
Beautiful part of this whole story is that, and you say this at the end of your piece, something like 95% of all the oranges that are used are picked by hand.
That's right. It's they've tried a lot of different mechanized forms to try to pick oranges more efficiently. But when it comes right down to it, good old hand labor is the best way to pick an orange to keep it protected and get that to the plant at the cheapest cost. So far, that's the way they do it.
Now, are you a pulp guy or not a pulp guy?
Oh, big-time pulp guy. Love pulp.
Dwayne Stanford, he covers beverages for Bloomberg News and Bloomberg Businessweek. Dwayne, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Coming up.
The sort of old adage that true love will find you when you least expect it, and therefore you should sort of sit around and wait, isn't a good strategy in any potential conceivable sense.
Not very romantic, but quite possibly true. First, though, let's do the numbers. Well, it turns out what goes down can come back up. The Dow Industrials recouped most of Monday's loss, rose 99 points, blue chips did, 0.7%, closed at 13,979. The NASDAQ gained 40 points, 1.3%, finished at 3171. The S&P 500 ticked up 15 points. That is 1%, closed at 1511. Tech shares gave the broader market a bump today. Computer Sciences jumped 9% on strong earnings. Dell, as we told you, could soon stop trading publicly. But today, in the meanwhile, Dell shares rose 1.1% as investors reacted to the $24 billion buyout plan. Microsoft, which will be one of Dell's new stakeholders, saw its shares rise 0.2%. More misery from McGraw-Hill, owner of Standard & Poor's credit rating service. Shares lost 10% today after dropping more than 13% on Monday. Rival credit agency Moody's suffered some contagion. Investors downgraded its shares nearly 9% today. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. A ceremonial swearing-in takes place at the Department of State for John Kerry. He's the 68th U.S. Secretary of State. Visa reports quarterly earnings. We'll see if it's everywhere it wants to be. And does your pet have bad breath? I just hate it when that happens. Fortunately, February is National Pet Dental Health Month. Time to get Fido a toothbrush. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You know that saying, it's easier to get a job when you have one? The opposite is quite possibly true as well, that it's harder to get a job when you don't have one. And so the longer you've been out of a job, the harder it is to find work. Still, people do make it out of long-term unemployment. Kate Davidson spoke with one of them.
There are about 4.8 million long-term unemployed, people out of work 27 weeks or longer. Jason Grote was one of them. In 2010, he was laid off from a job teaching English at Rutgers University in New Jersey, shortly before his son was born.
It was extremely difficult. I spent a lot of time trying to navigate the public assistance system.
Trying to get the baby insured. He and his wife ended up paying their son's medical costs out of pocket. Months passed as Grote looked for work. By this time, more than a quarter of successful job searches lasted 6 months or longer.
We talked about the possibility of bankruptcy, although the majority of my wife's and my debt is student loan debt, so it wouldn't eliminate that. We had a lot of conversations about what we would do in case things really didn't pan out. But at the same time, I also did a lot of scrambling around to figure out a new way to make it work.
Grote says having a child pushed him to get serious about, if not a career switch, a career shift. The English teacher and playwright decided to try TV. He asked friends for advice, and after a year of unemployment, he got a made-for-TV break, writing for the musical drama Smash.
Not a girl with a hunger for fame.
I felt just extraordinarily lucky. I felt just tremendous gratitude.
Today, Grote lives in California, and he writes for the show Mad Men. He knows many of the long-term unemployed don't get a Hollywood ending, or even one that includes supporting their families. I'm Kate Davidson for Marketplace.
Our education correspondent, Amy Scott, has spent a good part of the past year in Cincinnati, Ohio, working on a series about a school and its neighborhood. Euler School has been trying to build a community, in part by concentrating on things outside the classroom. Until Euler added a high school 8 years ago, almost nobody from that neighborhood got a diploma, much less went to college. Now that more kids are graduating, though, Euler is trying to raise ambitions beyond just high school, and that means starting early. From the education desk at WYPR, here's Amy.
There's a parade of cute coming down the hallway, a gaggle of first graders walking single file, each one wearing a construction paper crown with a Penn State or University of Delaware logo. The procession passes a classroom door decked out with the Seton Hall mascot. Today, every door at Euler has been decorated to represent a college or university. The kids walk past the University of Georgia, Auburn, Cincinnati State. These 6- and 7-year-olds are still learning to read, so they practice.
Start here and go down.
University of Missouri.
Then they come to another door with letters cut out from magazines like a ransom note.
Oh my gosh, read this door as you go by it.
7-year-old Mark Tobin sounds out the words.
Did you know?
Try to read that door.
College graduates make almost twice as much money as people who don't have a degree.
Does it make you want to go to college?
Yes.
And that's pretty much the point of this day, to get kids from preschool to 12th grade talking and thinking about college.
When I came to Euler, there was like this complete absence of college. Nobody even knew what a college was.
That's Euler's principal, Craig Hockenberry. When he took the job 12 years ago, Euler only went through eighth grade. Without a high school in their neighborhood, most kids eventually dropped out. So Euler added a high school, and Hockenberry set about building a college-going culture at the school, almost from scratch. He says most Euler parents never finished high school, let alone went to college.
It's not a dinner table topic, and there's not a lot of dinner tables in Lower Price Hill, you know. So there's a lot of absence of conversation with parents about that.
Today, Euler has that conversation. Teachers and staff wear college gear. There's a recruiting fair in the gym, and every class devotes an hour to talking about college.
Every college, no matter how big or small, is its own little community, its own little city, so to speak.
Teacher Joe Saylor shows his class of fifth graders all the fun things to do at Hocking College.
You have Dance Club, Dungeons and Dragons Club, Hotel and Restaurant Club.
It's a small public college in Ohio. A recent Euler graduate goes there.
Why are we looking at Hocking College? Because this is direct evidence that if you graduate high school from Euler, you can go to college. You can succeed.
Saylor says that's a message kids from Euler need to hear long before a sophomore or junior year.
You have to plant that seed early. They have to believe it and believe it and believe it, because the sad truth is not only are they not hearing it at home, they may be hearing the opposite at home. You're not going to go to college. You're no better than me. Nobody from our families ever went to college.
Saylor knows. He grew up a block away from the school. He also knows college isn't for everyone. This year, Euler's added trades into the mix, like plumbing and auto detailing. At the recruiting fair in the gym, senior Richard Carter checks out an apprentice program in construction. He could start making around $15 an hour right out of school while taking some classes.
I wanted to actually do something hands-on where they pay me so I don't have to pay them that much.
The real mission of this day is to encourage kids to set their sights beyond high school. Joe Saylor's fifth graders seem to be getting the message. Their guest speaker arrives, an admissions rep from Wilmington College.
How many of you guys want to go to college one day?
All of them raise their hands.
That's good. That's good.
In Cincinnati, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
We've got the rest of Amy's stories on her series about the Euler School on our website. It's marketplace.org. This next interview may ring true for some of you out there, those who at one point or another realized they were looking for love in all the wrong places. If that sounds familiar, then you'll relate to Amy Webb's story, in which she tries and fails at online dating and then does those matching algorithms one better. Her new book is called Data, A Love Story. Amy, it's nice to have you with us.
So great to be here.
So listen, I'm going to do something I don't usually do at the beginning of the interview, but I'm going to insult you a little bit. You ready?
Yeah.
Okay. You were a mess, man. Your love life was just, oh my goodness.
Yeah, it was pretty bad. It was pretty bad.
Did you know it at the time that you were a mess?
I think I was going through, I think a lot of people who are looking to find love, you know, wind up going down different paths that ultimately don't serve them the best. And they either wind up in marriages that are unhappy or single and wishing that they were in marriages. I think that the story is pretty transcendent.
You know, so your mom and your sister and a friend or two feature prominently in this book, mostly as sounding boards after you've had horrible experiences. And I can't help but wonder whether at some point they didn't say to you, whatever happened to finding a nice guy in the supermarket?
Yeah, they actually tried to set me up with somebody who worked in the supermarket.
How did that go?
That didn't go well. The sort of old adage that true love will find you when you least expect it, Therefore you should sort of sit around and wait, isn't a good strategy in any potential conceivable sense.
So you sit down one night and you come up with, I'm looking at it now actually, you come up with a list of 72 things. And you run the gamut from must want two children to be of medium build, not fat, not skinny.
Right.
Also 5'10 to 6'2".
Right. I got very granular. And here's why. Because when I thought about the people that I had gone out with previously, I was trying to identify where things were going wrong and also what we shared in common. And if I made a list, you know, the list might have said, well, smart, funny.
Yeah.
And those are analogous to me making a grocery store list that said meat and produce, right?
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't identified my audience. I couldn't target my audience. I really had no idea what I was looking for besides, you know, a husband.
But what you have then in the end is this matrix that works for you. And it kind of gives lie to the notion of Match.com can fix you up because we got a gazillion, you know, points of comparison and eHarmony can do this. I mean, you built a matrix that works for you and your matrix is not going to work for me.
You're absolutely right. The matrix that I built, the math that I used, that made sense for me. But for somebody else, as long as you have a list, you know, and you prioritize that list in some way, using stickers, using check marks, using emoticons, whatever makes sense, that framework can be totally personalized and individualized for everybody.
I'm happy to report that the story does have a happy ending, right? You found a guy.
I sure did. Once I had all of this sort of data in place, and it took 3 weeks of me waiting to find somebody who had crossed the sort of magic threshold of numbers, and we finally went out.
So we have your husband in the studio there, right? Sit next to you?
We do.
All right, good. Hey, Brian, how are you?
I'm doing great.
I have to ask you how you feel about being the end product of all this data analysis.
Very, very lucky.
Come on, you had to say that. She's sitting right there.
Well, that's true. But at the same point, it was very interesting when she showed me the list for the first time.
Yeah. You didn't know, right, that you were—
No, not at all.
Yeah.
No, but very early on in our courtship, within I think it was date 3 or 4,
yeah.
You know, she kind of showed me the background and what she had come up with. And I had this sort of brief moment of, did she conjure me? It was very kind of— unusual moment, but mainly I was very excited because I was checking off all the things that I qualified for. So, oh, I got this, I got that, I got this.
Are you in fact 5'10" to 6'2"?
Actually, I am.
Brian Wolf is married to Amy Webb, and her book is called Data, A Love Story. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out today, in which we learn size really does matter. A study out of the University of North Carolina says CEOs who have big signatures are more likely to overspend and thus have lower sales growth and revenues. It's a psychological thing, apparently. Big signatures are evidence of narcissism, which in the executive capacity can be detrimental to corporate health. Interestingly, big handwriting CEOs tend to have above average compensation. So there you have it. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow up 99.7%. The NASDAQ gained 40 points, 1.3%. The S&P 500 ticked up 15 points. That is 1%. Thanks to Sean Bowditch, Katie Long, and Justin Ho on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rada Bead. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.